describe that as working at a cell phone store, or would you say I worked for a cell phone company?
I worked at both. A cell phone store and a cell phone company. Like a Russian doll egg. At the same time,
or two different.
So the Matryoshka, the nesting dolls?
Mm-hmm. I worked in a building that was in a cell phone store. No, that's not right.
What?
I was in a cell phone store that was in a building, and that building was in Verizon Wireless. No, that doesn't make sense either. So
what are you fucking talking about?
Are there cell phone stores that aren't in buildings?
There are kiosks, but they're still in a building. Yeah.
Yeah. There's in a mall.
Okay.
Still a building.
Still a building. If you go out to California, though, they have malls that aren't like really malls. They're like kind of open-air malls. So if you had a kiosk at one of those places, you would be just in an umbrella, under an umbrella. And what about, not technically in a building.
But here's where I'm going with this. Which is what I'm seeing in my head. Food truck that sells cell phones.
That's just... If that sounds so shady.
You could drive a food truck into the cell phone store.
No, because then it's in a building again. You took a sip. You're alive.
Yeah, it's good.
You like it?
It's good.
Good. Yep.
All right. I'm so afraid of this.
You probably should be. Take a very small sip.
What's this called?
This is grappa. This is chamomile grappa.
Oh, dear God.
It's not fucking around. Italians don't understand that drinking should be pleasurable. Italians think, hey, I could have put this in my jet plane, or I could have put this in myself.
It's very sweet. It's coating my entire digestive system.
It's thick. It's viscous.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. It's just like overwhelming.
Tiny sips, and you'll be okay. And it will become cloying after a while. I apologize for that. Hi, we are Buddies in Space. You are?
S. Michael Smith. You, next to well, I... On my left.
We fucked this up already.
I know.
I am M. Michael Crossi, and we are joined by special guest...
Ben.
Ben.
The Ben who needs no introduction.
Oh, well then, I guess that's
well,
the
button.
You should probably introduce me, actually. Ben Corey.
Benjamin Corey.
Does Benjamin...
Do you want to put some context behind that?
Behind Benjamin Corey?
Yeah.
Is Benjamin okay, or do you like, nah, don't call me
Ben would be best.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've never been a Benji, right?
Definitely not Benji. No. There's really no other versions of my name that I like. Although Jen calls me Benny every once in a while. But let's not say that.
No.
Sorry.
Don't go there. I'm just saying that because I'm sure that's overdone in your life.
Yeah, Ben is good.
Ben, I feel like Ben, like Mike... lends itself to Mikey, Michael. I feel like people like to fuck with that name a bit. Ben is just, it's Ben.
Well, there's a lot of them. I would say there's, I can make 7 versions of my name.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you
There's Ben,
okay.
Uh-huh. Benjamin,
2.
Benj, Benji,
yeah.
Benny,
yeah.
5.
Benjamin.
I think you're stretching, but okay. What about Benjamin?
And Benjamin. There you go.
We'll call you Benjamin.
Yep.
What about Ben-Hur?
That's 7.
Yeah, Ben-Hur?
Ben-Hur is like that's a different name, I think.
Yeah.
If I was on a chariot, you'd have to call me Ben-Hur. But I'm on
a
chair, so just call me
Ben.
Yeah,
I would. You're on a chair.
Right. Exactly.
No.
Damn it. So, okay, so the context that you are so desperately looking for the listeners to have... I've been looking forward to this podcast for a while. We have had awesome guests in the past, and this is going to be no exception. Ben is my closest friend from high school. And Mike is wincing, but I think it's because of the grappa.
Yeah, it is. No, that has nothing to do with what you're saying. Continue!
I'm just dying a little bit! My throat is constricting from the pain.
Oh my gosh.
But there's no sulfite, so it's okay.
I know. It makes my rusty nails seem like water now.
You have more hair in your chest after this.
That's a tall order.
It's a tall order.
Should we count them now so that we can count them afterwards?
Oh, shit. Well, I've been ready.
That would be
I don't think we have time for that.
Yeah, that's a lot of... Wow. Your stomach has as much hair as your head. Your hair is your chest.
And my ass.
And your ass.
I know you didn't want to say it, but yes.
I was... Yeah, I know. I know.
So you're wearing a sweater.
That's going to need to be shaved again. That's all I'm saying. Very soon.
I don't understand why your wife won't do it. Why does it have to be me? Sometimes you get stuck. The trimmer gets stuck in all the ass hair.
So who's this guy again?
Are we getting a little too personal for you, Smite? So Ben and I, in the days before geeks were cool.
Yeah, that's right. We started it.
We totally started it. Sorry, Smite. It was not you. It was us. Ben and I were in Mr. Brannon's math class together. You were ahead. I was on track, which meant I was behind in my advanced math career. And you had a t-shirt on, and I poked you. I was new to school, and I poked you on the shoulder, and I said, hey, does that stand for Inquest Magazine? IQ? Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, it does.
Right. And if anybody if anybody listening to this knows what Inquest Magazine is, I give you 100 points for
geekiness. I don't even know what that is.
That was the Dungeons & Dragons magazine.
Wow.
That was the Gary Gygax approved TSR magazine.
Well, and they had the values for the cards, for like magic cards in the back too. Mm-hmm. So you could look through and see.
But that was later.
The card is worth $80.
Hmm. Oh, was that a price guide too?
$80, yeah.
Oh, I didn't remember that. Wait a minute. There was Inquest and there's Dragon Magazine. Maybe I'm thinking of Dragon Magazine. I totally fucked this up. So Inquest was the price guide.
Yep.
Yeah.
You did not get 100 points.
Wow. Hey, I recognize the t-shirt.
I'm the only one starting out with 100 points, and I've never been here before.
Well, you win. Yeah, so we beat Final Fantasy VII together. Ben had to talk me through my meltdown over Silent Hill.
Yep.
In broad daylight. That was a rough one.
We almost lost you that day.
We did almost lose me.
We took down the Death Star together on
32X. Sega 32X.
Oh, nice.
The mushroom.
Yeah, I didn't have. I just had the Sega CD.
Sega CD was way cooler than 32X.
Yeah, there was like maybe what, 5 games for 32X.
Just about, and they were not like you couldn't take a 16-bit system and then slap something to it and say, oh, it's now all the way up to 32 bits. It doesn't work. So it just looked like some shitty fucking games. I mean, shitty games that were just, they didn't look right. They would look better in 16-bit than whatever they were doing. And they got slow. Yep. It was a lot of stutter, I remember. Mm-hmm. And then the end of Star Wars was like super insulting.
The only thing I remember about that game is that it was really hard.
Yeah.
And we played that game for so long to beat it. Mm-hmm. And you remember the ending?
Yeah, the ghosts. The little cardboard cutout like Obi-Wan, and it was insulting.
So to reward you for your effort, you get to see a picture of Obi-Wan Kenobi, someone else.
Yoda.
And it says, may the Force be with you.
It was the lamest, most disappointing thing. Yeah. There was no payoff.
It I might as well have said, may you go fuck yourself.
Thanks for the money.
For spending all this time on this game.
So, may the Force be that. That's what you want before you go on the mission.
Right.
May the Force be with
that's
you.
That's a.
Free... When you get back, you're like, hey, let's party.
Not, right.
You know, you don't need the Force now.
I'm done.
I blew the thing up.
It's done. I don't need the Force anymore. I'm done with the Force. I want to do shots with some fucking ghosts. Yeah. I mean, what else are you going to do? I was so angry, I almost wanted to put the Death Star back together. Be like, fuck you guys.
So then a bunch of stuff happened, and then we were on a podcast together.
Yeah. That's pretty succinctly fills it all in.
So the sad part of the story is that now you guys live some distance away.
Right.
We're trying. Eric and I are trying. Because they don't have kids, so they'd be good surrogate friends to you and your wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do talk to us about moving to Rochester a lot.
We lay it on kind of thick. We've been good this visit. We have not really, I think this is the first time we brought it up. No, Erica made a very idle comment. I was like, well done, wife. Well done.
Snuck it into the conversation.
So anyway, I'm like, the political landscape is awful, but Rochester is great.
we were actually just talking when we got here about how we've recently come to the conclusion that we don't want kids. So, we have number. We have number.
Mike, fist bump just happened between Smike and Ben. Listening. And that's cool. That's fine. We have plenty of friends with kids. Be the novelties. That's great for us because we can see you. Seeing people with kids is so much work when you have one.
Yeah.
It is, isn't it? I mean, that's not really a.
No, I'm not kidding. Yeah, we don't. I mean, we have good friends that we rarely see, and it's not out of not wanting to see them. It's just like, you've got X number of kids. We're still figuring the parenting thing out. Our son will kind of just take off at a moment's notice, so we have to watch him the whole time, you know? So it's kind of, like, I feel bad. Like, I see people once a year or twice a year, and my eyes never make eye contact because I'm just constantly watching my kid roam around.
Right.
And I'm multitasking as much as you can, but, you know, it just feels So when you don't mix more kids into it, I think it's easier to spend time with that person. Or
when there's only one kid in the equation that needs to be handled, monitored. Arranged, monitored.
Yes. Like a radar.
Dealt with.
My kid, you spent a lot of time with us. Like Eric and I have pretty good kid dar. We kind of generally know by echolocation where he is. When it's too quiet, we start to worry. That's a good indication that something's wrong because he's not usually quiet.
The sound of glass breaking is also, you know, kind of an alert.
Just comfortable at this point. It's just a comforting sound.
And Simon's job is to find something dangerous to do or to get into, pretty much. Your job is to make sure that he does. That's the game that you play.
That's the game.
And then 18 years later, they leave.
Yep. To make sure it's not too dangerous.
But we don't want it too easy either.
Right.
You can't nerf everything.
You've got to adjust the difficulty level.
Basically, he's like beat level one. Now he's on level two now. So now it's like, oh, you hit your head under the table? Fucking learn from that.
I think he's still going through the tutorial, though. That's
it's right. Only because he can't read.
It's like press X to stand up.
Press X to pay respects, Call of Duty. I'm sorry. I did not mean to co-opt that. So yeah, so that was a bit of a surprise to us.
Yeah, because we had talked about before that we wanted to have kids. Now, these things change. I mean, there's a chance that, like, 10 years ago, this audio recording could be used against me to really disappoint my children.
You were going to vote for Ben for best dad ever, and then you heard this podcast.
But for right now, we like our life, and we, you know, it's so much more complicated with children. And that might be selfishness. I don't know.
It is, but Mike and his wife are selfish as well, and this is not in any way judgment.
I'm okay with that.
But that's the thing.
My parents are less okay with that.
We put up with you. Come on. No, there is... I think a lot about this because I can't... You know, at some point, every parent, I think, is like, oh, there's all this shit I can't do anymore. And you look at friends, you look at the dinks around you, the dual income, no kids, and you think... There's a level of selfishness that I miss so much. And it's not a mean statement. It's like, oh, man, just to be able to waste an entire evening and just not accomplish anything, that sounds amazing. I don't know what that's like.
For us, it's like a combination of laziness and cynicism. Because I don't really look at the world right now and think, yeah, I would love to bring a new life into this.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I do.
I think you guys have a lot of similar... I was saying to Ben, I was like, you know who, because Ben's very political, and I was saying, we're all the same aligned views, but I was saying to Ben yesterday, I was like, you know who never brings up politics to me? Anyone I know with children. It's like, I don't have the fucking time to think about that. I got, oh, drone just killed a bunch of people in a hotel.
But the funny thing is, you're the person that it means the most.
That's right. He made the same point, and it's the irony of, I don't have the bandwidth. Mm-hmm. You know? I think if you're really political before you have children, you'll carry it over.
Like, you know how in the 80s a bunch of fucked up shit happened in politics, and it's kind of had a lot of repercussions for now in our economy and that kind of thing. That kind of stuff is happening right now. Your kid's going to be an adult, and the reason that the world is either screwed up or a lot better is happening right now.
And I'm having nothing to do with it, nor am I aware of what it is.
Yeah, you're more aware than a lot of people, though.
I have you two as friends. If I didn't have you two as friends... Nothing. You'd be like, you know, as president, I'm like, I think I voted for him. It's a guy, right?
It's a guy at the moment.
It's a guy.
I think gay people
at least until Carly Fiorino becomes president of the country. That could happen.
Okay.
The previous CEO of Hewlett Packard could be our next president. And the solution to everything is going to be...
Layoffs. Right?
Add more paper. fix the print cartridge.
More paper and layoffs. Do we want to get political here?
I mean, we have in the past.
The Trump... whatever you want to call it, is blowing my mind. But I feel like it shouldn't be. It should be like the most obvious thing. Like, well, why didn't anybody see this happening?
The interesting thing to me about Trump is what seems to be working for him, because he doesn't, if it's apparent that he doesn't actually know anything about the way that the world works, Congress works, anything like that. I mean,
his face doesn't give a shit about any of that.
No. And people eat it up. Yeah. I mean, he says, when I'm president, we're going to have so much winning It's going to be, we're going to get tired of winning. And it's going to be so great. I mean, everything is going to be fixed. This country is going to be great. We're going to be run by smart people. I mean, he just keeps on saying those things over and over again.
It's rhetoric.
Yes. And there's no facts behind it. Like, he just disregards the fact that he's going to have to get Congress to vote, that he's going to have to convince people to get involved with the political system.
You know, his perfect running mate, Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. Winning. The guy's got it down.
Winning and winninger. Yeah. Winninginger.
Trump Sheen.
Yeah.
Trump Sheen.
Putting the sheen on the Trump.
Trump Sheen. Trump Sheen. Wait, no. You can't stop this, Trump Sheen.
Oh, my God.
You said it really well, though.
We shouldn't joke about this. This is going to become a reality.
We're giving people ideas. Yeah. Fuck. No. Fuck you all. This podcast cannot exist. You said it really well because you said he's got the perfect campaign concept. He just never apologizes.
I honestly think that people are going to study Trump in decades in political science classes. They're going to look back at this year and they're going to take something from it. And it might honestly change the way people run for president in the future. And this is the thing. This is what's going to change. No matter what gaffe happens, no matter what anyone says, because there's always, if you're running for president, you're going to say some stupid shit at some point that gets taken out of context.
Right.
But what they always do is they apologize for it. The only difference between Trump and anybody else who just talks is that he never, ever apologizes. He said something about Carly Fiorina. He said, look at that face. Who would want to be president? Who would want her to be president? Look at that face. And then people called him out on that bullshit. And he didn't apologize for it at all. And it's not the actual gaffe that people respond to that makes poll numbers go down. It's the apology. If these politicians never apologize, it's going to go great. They just have to learn from Donald Trump and do what he does.
That's terrifying.
It's absolutely terrifying.
It's a cabal of non-apologists.
Not just apologizing, but doing things that people would expect you to apologize for.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's meaningless if he just was nice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't. If he were Mr. Nice Guy, he would not be where he is right now.
Right.
It's throwing civility out the window.
Yep, and people say, I like it, because he's not polished, and he talks from his heart. But, I mean,
his heart's in his ass. That's the problem.
It's this, like, shriveled, vile, stinking,
he makes the Grinch look like he's got like a marathon runner, when you compare their hearts side by side. Also, it's in his asshole.
It's in his ass.
I'm making a sphincter. Would you describe this as a sphincter shape with my hand?
Well, it looks kind of like you're holding a tulip. But if you put it into that context, it does also look like it could be going into a butthole.
Sarlacc.
Working it up there.
Yeah, exactly. It's a fulcrum. Anyway, what were you saying? What insightful political message were you going to relay?
I don't think there's any remote chance he's actually going to be, even if he gets the nomination.
Same here.
That he would be elected.
I don't think he'll get the nomination. If he does get the nomination, there's no chance that he's going to win. Yes. And that's why he's not going to get the election. Hold on a
second. Just wanted to knock on wood there. Wait, just... All right. Okay, I got a couple of words.
So going back in politics for, I don't know, however long I've been into politics, I've been right a lot about a lot of things. I'm not going to go through and list them all. But it tends to be where there's always one side going, this is what's going to happen. And then another side going, this is what's going to happen. And all the times that I've said, no, this is going to happen, it comes true. So here's what's going to happen with Trump. You ready?
Yeah.
Right now, he's like between 21 and 24% in the polls.
Yeah.
Completely. Always. He's not going to go any higher than that. So as people, there's 14 people, I think, left in the Republican
Survivor.
Race. And as they start dropping out, those numbers are going to go toward
one
serious candidates. Right. And he's going to stay somewhere around 23-24%. And eventually when it counts, there's going to be someone else who's doing better. The question is, who is that going to
be? I think it's still going to be Jeb Bush. And although he's like hardly in the polls at all right now, I think the establishment's just going to find a way to
Democrats shove him through the system. So they want a Bush.
Yeah.
You know, I was really thinking about it before the last debate, and I was thinking about the fact that Carly Fiorina is the logical candidate because she's very, very good in those debates. Like, for you and me and Mike, we'll see her talking, and She just makes stuff up and everything like that. But she's a very effective speaker. And you listen to her at the debates, she knows what she's talking about. She is informed about some stuff. Like if you ask her about overseas, she's very good on that. Like she's definitely had people prepping her for the last 4 years about running for president. And I think that she would be a logical pick just because of the fact that this is a year where there's an outsider. You know, that's the big thing is, are we going to elect an outsider? And also, you know, I forgot where I was going. But the other thing is, now there's a chance that on the Democratic side, we're going to have Bernie Sanders instead of Hillary Clinton. That could happen. I don't know that it's going
to
happen.
It could.
I'd like to see it. I don't think it's going to
happen. Biden's just as good of a chance as anyone right now.
Mm-hmm. You think really?
Biden.
Really?
I think if he decides
if he jumps in, I think you might be right.
Because people are looking for a reason to not go with Hillary.
Yeah.
I think a lot of these strategists will say to themselves, you know, there's a lot of women that are voting for Hillary, mm-hmm. no matter what. And, you know, on the Republican side, our answer to that could be Carly Fiorina.
Right.
And we'll pull a lot of those votes over to our side. And so the strategic thinking might be, let's try to get a woman running for president. And that's very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very skilled candidate. So even though that sounds crazy that the leader of Hewlett-Packard could be the Republican nominee, it could really happen.
Didn't she get, like, voted off the board or whatever? I mean, she wasn't the president for very long, right?
She was the president, and what happened is that Hewlett-Packard ended up buying Compaq. And that turned out in hindsight to be a terrible move. It really almost sunk the company completely, because Compaq was not a profitable company.
No.
So they bought out a non-profitable company, and that took it out of their, you know, their revenue
mm-hmm.
dropped. Well, their revenue, there's always these selective statistics that she can give about how their revenue went up. But basically it was a worse off company.
Yeah,
after
they had big layoffs after that.
Yep, so they fired her and, you know, lost a bunch of jobs. And now, without really any point in her life where she can say this was a clear success, she's running for president. Yeah, and because this is a year where everybody says, you know, fuck the norm, it could happen. It's interesting.
What we need is a female Donald Trump. That's what we need.
I don't know if that exists.
I hope not.
Donald Trump wears his balls. Like, if he could, he would wear his balls on his chest, on the outside of his shirt.
Right.
Just to show people that he has balls.
And he kind of, like, stroke them, like, lapels. Like, you know, like, yep, these are my balls I'm stroking right on camera. Your kid, looking at my balls right now, because they're so fucking big. Donald Trump.
Right.
For president.
And this could be the guy that's sitting in a room negotiating with our enemies across the table.
It is kind of a funny thought.
He's going to have control of the nuclear codes. And so,
but just to see him go, you're fired. Just to like the leader of Iran. Just the image is funny.
You
want
fired.
Me to fire my nuclear weapons? Okay, sure, Mr. President, no problem.
Well, let's give him a cabinet position. Let's make him Secretary of Reality Television.
God, there should be a fucking Secretary of that, shouldn't there?
Mm-hmm.
He should just be Secretary of Fuck You.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that when there's no recourse when we are going to war, you send Trump in, and you're like, fuck you, motherfuckers. This is my job and I relish it. I was telling Ben, because I firmly believe the political system is so fucked that there is no, you have to tear it down and rebuild it. Like, you have to do something insane at this point. So
we're on the way. We're
definitely heading there.
We're working on it.
I have something slightly different, though. I want to see a temporary, quote unquote, for like 100 years, fourth branch of the government introduced, whose sole purpose is to streamline every process within the government. That and they have checks and balances in place. I don't know how. That's someone smarter than me. But they are given that authority to go through every single facet of our government and streamline all the bloated, easily manipulated processes. And then when they're done, say 100 years from now, they just get absorbed into the other three branches, so that lives on. And then the government at least runs simpler. I don't actually think this is realistic at all. But these are the kind of thoughts I have.
Probably not. No.
These are the thoughts I have.
Yeah, those are very general things to have them doing. But I mean, if I think we have somebody who could lead that department, and that would be Donald Trump.
Your process is that's three steps too many. You're fired!
Yeah. But he is the lubrication that is going to move this country into the
always
next
comes back to the balls
generation.
With you, doesn't it?
Yeah. That would be executive, judicial, legislative, and lubricative. That would be what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's how I envision it. You're right. That is absolutely... The wheels got to spin and they got to not squeak, man. And, you know, being stuck in the Orwellian nightmare that I've been in with my father's burial, I just see it. The government's ridiculous.
Well, the Constitution... I do agree that we need to look at how our government runs. And I think the Constitution was written to allow changes. And right. So... That's what we need to do. We do need at this point to change the way that we pass laws and the way that, I mean, I think the fact that you need now 60 votes. Or 60% to pass any law because of the fact that they just filibuster everything.
Mm-hmm.
They need to do something about that.
It's gotten too manipulated and there's too many hacks to it. Like, you have to reset. I'm just going to go pure video game mode. Just fucking reset it, rebuild it, recode it, do something because it's not working the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given an escape hatch. We were given when it gets really bad, the people, the populace will rise up and overthrow the government if they would just put their cell phones down long enough to notice what the fuck is going on around. We are at that point. 200 years ago, the average person without an education would have been like, this shit's fucked. This 1% shit. No, fuck that. We're rising up. Now we're like, you know, whatever. Selfie in front of the Eiffel Tower statue by Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually amazing how few people really engage in the political process at all. And as far as at least being knowledgeable about it and voting, that's the bare minimum I think that people should do is vote and kind of know where they're voting.
So let's talk about that. Okay, so you two are both intelligent, politically aware people. How much work do you put into having to stay politically aware and get real information?
A lot, actually. Yeah. I mean, I read up on articles online.
The Atlantic.
Fairly often. Yeah. And it's...
Loves The Atlantic.
Well, and this might even go back to some of the stuff you were talking about earlier, because we have some free time for this sort of thing.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
That's what
I said
about
bandwidth. The average person certainly doesn't.
When you got a little kid, you don't have the bandwidth. I mean, I know it's a corporate term, but I don't have the bandwidth mentally to be like, I'm going to spend 2 hours catching up on politics right now. I don't have fucking time to do that.
Yeah, I don't actually blame people who don't have a lot of time to really put the work in that it needs to get the straight story these days.
Because I do
blame the media because it could be a lot easier for people to follow the truth. And I have something that's worked for me great. And I do a lot of reading and stuff like that too. I read and I read as much from like conservative blogs and Fox News and watch that stuff as much as I watch anything else. Because
smart, you got to balance it.
I got to know, like, what are both sides of this? Mm-hmm. And I've gotten really good at sniffing out bullshit. But
yeah.
Your nose must be clogged all the time.
But here's what someone can do if they just want to be able to watch the news 1 hour or so and know what's going on. And I've figured this out. And maybe PBS would be a good way to do it, too, because I think PBS does good news, but it seems to be really boring.
Yeah.
That's the problem
PBS
with that.
And BBC, that's usually the thing you hear. It's like, oh, they're trustworthy, but I don't...
They spend a lot of time on stuff that I don't think is that important.
Yeah, it used to be you just, like, say, watch McNeil Lehrer, and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
But...
Well, here it is. So,
The Ben Method. 1 hour. 1 hour of work.
I figured this out in the last few months. If you watch CNN at 2 a.m., at 2 a.m. Eastern time, for people that are in Guatemala.
Of which we have an abnormally large listenership.
It's a huge, huge Guatemala.
We may have hit a snag already.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned here.
So, okay, 2 a.m. on CNN, set your DVR. CNN Newsroom is called. And then you watch that the next day whenever you want to watch the news. Here's what happens at 2 a.m. on CNN. Some Australian people get on. We have to get our news from non-American people. So some Australian people get on. You can tell from the accents. But they do news that's based on America. It's American and world news. They're not doing Australian news.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually very straight covering of American politics.
Huh.
They cover what's happening in the world, the refugee crisis, everything that's happening in the world, so you have some idea of that. Because really, okay. if you watch CNN during the day, it's all politics, only they're not really telling you anything. It's just noise. But I guess by the end of the day at 2 a.m., there's
no one's stopping anyone from reporting normal
there's
news.
Nobody that really cares that much about ratings. And they have enough time to put things in perspective on what happened that day.
That's true.
So, 2 a.m., CNN, listen to the Australian people, and you'll get a good summation of the news.
So, the newsroom, the show, the amazing HBO show, The Newsroom, mm-hmm. is CNN's 2 a.m. slot?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it is.
Did you watch that show?
It's great. I love that show.
You never saw it, right?
No.
Everyone, if you haven't seen it, you need to just YouTube the monologue from the very first episode. I just rewatched it 2 days ago. Jeff Daniels, the premise of the show is Jeff Daniels is a very conservative Republican newscaster
mm-hmm.
who I'm trying to think who you would liken him to in real life.
I really like any newscaster that's doing a show where that's driven by ratings, which is most of the shows that are on prime mm-hmm. time and everything like that. They care about what's going to get ratings. So you can almost take any newscaster, conservative, Democrat, in between, and that's who you can compare the beginning
to. And he's like the amalgamation of all of them.
Yeah, he's worried about what ratings are we going to get.
Mm-hmm. Like a Wolf Blitzer, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. Wolf Blitzer is a good example.
Because he's smart. He's a very intelligent guy. He's a lawyer. So the like very beginning, you know, he's had a very long career and he's got like the number four slot. So he's not like number one, but he's got a really good slot ratings wise. And he goes to this campus, you know, Q&A kind of thing. And someone asks, why is America the best country in the world? And so you get like the canned responses from the conservative other and the liberal. And then he just has a breakdown. And then he has this amazing monologue where he says,
the answer is. It's not.
It's not. And he lists every reason why it's not. And it's just fucking riveting to watch. And he can't stop himself. And he like stops at one point and then he keeps going. Then he goes, this is why we used to be. And like it's all like basically all the Tea Party rhetoric and everything he's been holding in, like he can't, like it just breaks. And so the whole 3-season show is about them trying to take this revelation of honesty and actually tell the news. And in the current climate of the world, it's next to impossible to tell the news like honestly without a bent, and everyone just tries to fuck with them and his own party, and it's a fascinating show. And it's basically Sports Night. If you ever watch Sports Night, it's the same. It's Sorkin. Mm-hmm. So it's the exact premise of Sports Night. I don't know if you ever watched it.
Kind of
exact same show, but instead of sports, it's news, and like the character archetypes are all there, but it's phenomenal. It's like liberal porn. I mean, there's so much like fantasy stuff to it.
Well, I just think it's truth porn. I mean, honestly, like if you're it's all about getting to the truth of the matter, telling what's important, and yeah,
trying not to be biased.
That can be seen as a liberal thing. I'm sure a lot of people watch that show. And
oh, it almost got canceled because there were the conservatives that hated it. So this is just liberal propaganda on a TV show. Aaron Sorkin, you gay Hollywood gay guy. Everyone in Hollywood's gay, according to conservatives. You remember when Jon Stewart hosted the Oscars and he's like, you know, a lot of people see you guys on the West Coast as, you know, like disconnected and selfish. I didn't have a joke there. I just wanted to let you know what everyone thought of you.
Well, that truth thing goes back to what Colbert said at the press conference where he grilled George W. Bush.
Uh-huh.
And he said, everyone knows that the truth has a liberal bias. And it was crickets in the room, much like this room. When I just said that. But I mean, the truth is that if you follow the truth of the matter, and I think that the criticism on the media is that a lot of them tend to be liberal, but they're hiding it.
Right.
And I think that part of that might be because of the fact that they're there. I mean, they're getting the true story. A lot of those reporters. And so if they're trying to tell the straight story, you know, I think that a lot of that tends to go along with the liberal story.
Well, because you're not trying to spin it and fire people up and use rhetoric and use the Socratic method. There is an inherent, I don't know much about politics anymore or ever did, but I recognize because I feel sick to my stomach when I watch a conservative speaking, it's because I'm being manipulated. And one of my pet peeves is being manipulated. I'm too smart to be manipulated very easily. And if you try, it makes me so fucking angry that it just broils my stomach. It just roils is what I meant to say. or I have actual royals. Like, I eat the royal family and they're in my stomach and they're like, ah! But that's why the joke is there's truth to there's a liberalness to truth, only in that if you're not manipulating the truth, it's what you would think the liberals are doing by not trying to rile up the right and turn it into a religious argument or something.
Yeah, and what ends up happening is that one side ends up looking softer than the other side. A lot of people respond to that. Oh, yeah. And honestly, I think that the Democrats should have a lot more spine. There's a lot of things I could say that the Democrats are doing wrong.
Yeah.
But they need to have a spine. They need to take advantage of people's anger because this country's not working.
What about all the angry intellectuals? There's a lot of them. They're out there. And no one's playing to that.
Angry intellectuals tend to talk about it on podcasts and that kind of thing.
I know what you're talking about.
But I think angry Republicans tend to go out there and they tend to get the message out.
Well, but I'm saying is they're playing to the Midwest is a really easy group to play to, right? You play family values. I'm sorry, I know you're from.
I wouldn't say the Midwest as much as I would say rural America.
Okay, that's fair. Mm-hmm. Rural America.
Because that's really how it breaks down.
It's upstate New York.
Because
too.
You get the pockets of I was going to say civilization, but cities is a better word.
Okay.
Is a better word. Civilization is a poor choice.
That's
But I'm putting out there that I made a poor choice initially.
Civilization was a poor choice.
Yeah, the major cities tend to be more liberal progressive.
And that can be tied to
wherever you go.
Income and education level. And yeah, I mean, look at Austin in the middle of Texas. It's a great example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're a shining beacon.
But the rural areas tend to be more conservative, more likely to go with a Tea Party sort of candidate.
But the reason being, it's very easy because you play to home family values, you play to religion, you play to the stuff that they know, and they're not challenged by being, like in a city, you're constantly being introduced to new things, right? Mm-hmm. You can't help but expand your mind. It's like travel. You don't see the rural person travel a lot. It's the same kind of thing.
Right.
You know? So, but no one's doing that for the cities as much. Of course, the problem with the cities is they don't swing the vote for a state the way you would think necessarily. You know?
No.
I think in New York they do.
Yeah, in New York, I mean, if you just took upstate New York and let them vote, we'd always come up with a Republican
candidate. But we don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's because the population density in New York City is so great and the rest of New York is so spread out. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to shift things a bit.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure.
So I don't know how much you want to talk about it, but you recently had been a massive life change, like entirely voluntarily.
You're talking about... Wait, what are you talking about?
The massive life
change. Oh, yeah, okay.
Did you join a cult?
I thought you could hear me in the bathroom earlier, and you were talking about that, because that was pretty massive.
Ben, your shit talks back to you. That is amazing to me.
I was working for Verizon Wireless. A telecommunications company.
Do you want me to edit that out?
I'm not going to.
For 7 years, living in the corporate life.
My fault. I got you there.
Well, yeah. I mean, indirectly. Yeah, definitely that. And was kind of promoted up the chain on that. I did
also
well
my
with
fault.
Verizon. Yeah, Mike got me promoted.
Pulling the strings.
Called in a few favors.
Behind the scenes.
And then I just didn't want to do it anymore. So I came to a point in my life where I felt like I was going to work and killing myself and then leaving work. And still thinking about work, going to sleep and still thinking about work. And
did you have work dreams?
Oh, constantly. And this is the kind of job where I worked in a retail store where we, we did a lot of coaching to people's sales techniques. And so you're really talking about it's really easy in like in most retail situations to say like, hey, before you ring that up, make sure you do this. Make sure you smile to the customer. It's a very kind of wishy-washy psychological thing to coach people in sales that are doing these kind of things. But ultimately, like, I was putting so much mental energy into doing this that I said, why am I trying to work for something that ultimately in the end I don't really believe in? I like the gadgets and I like the fact that we have this stuff, and I really enjoyed for a long time that I was part of that technology.
You always had the newest phone.
Yeah, I mean, when I started with Verizon, the BlackBerry had just come out, and really there wasn't such a thing as the smartphone. You know, the iPhone was announced the same summer that I started. Mm-hmm. So I really, through that whole period where everyone went from using a dumb phone to a smartphone, I was there.
That's cool.
Which was mm-hmm. interesting. But ultimately, like, the amount of work that I was putting into it and the amount that it was a detriment to the rest of my life, it didn't make sense, the end result. I wasn't getting as much out of it mentally. So I just decided, if I'm going to work as hard as possible, I'm going to work for myself. And so I just left, and I didn't have immediately another job to go to or anything like that.
You downshifted.
Yeah.
So how nerve-wracking was that decision when you made it?
Oh, it was amazingly nerve-wracking. And the guilt that comes along with going from, you know, being the person in your household that's making more of the money to going to somebody who's bringing in absolutely no money, except for unemployment.
You had unemployment when you quit?
Yeah, I did.
Holy shit, that's awesome.
It's a whole story.
Wow.
It's going to come out in my book, How to Manipulate the System. And
oh my God, you're the guy I'm going after with my fourth branch of government.
You son of a bitch. Quick, loop him up.
But I would make an argument, though, that the health repercussions your job was having on you.
That's kind of the argument that I made.
I think that's legitimate. Yeah. I saw what it was doing to you.
And the fact that it was a necessary thing, and the fact that I kind of felt at the time that Verizon was pushing me out, all of those things kind of went toward my case as far as why I should get
unemployment. Were they putting more pressure on you to make more sales?
It was a mind job.
Always.
But they gave you the worst store as a thing. Yeah,
and to be fair, I took the worst store.
But it was like a challenge.
It was a challenge. Yeah. I didn't feel that they gave me the tools that I needed to fix that store in terms of like being able to help customers without having them wait around for a long time. And boy, I could get into that big time. But I ultimately felt like, here's a company that really puts the face forward to its employees, that it really cares about its employees. But more than that, they care about the profits and they care about everything like that, of course. So I just wanted to get something that kind of suited my values a little bit more and was going to be, you know, if I'm going to work my ass off, I want to be doing it to make myself money. So I had been doing web design before I started for Verizon. But I was planning to go into it. And while I was doing my previous job, I would spend my lunch hours and breaks and stuff reading web design books. And so I got back into it, which took a lot of time to catch up.
It seems really weird that you would read a book about web design. Shouldn't there at least be a PDF of that?
Right. Well, I mean, I was in a parts truck in 2007 delivering parts for Toyota.
That's right.
And when I got some free time, I would sit in the back of the parts truck and read a HTML book. I was probably
among
the only
ratchets.
Parts delivery driver that was doing that. But so yeah, I'm doing web design now and doing the best that I can to get that going, which is a lot of work. And it's like, you have a lot of pressure on you as the person that's not at a job, however many hours a week, to get a lot of the non-job stuff done. Mm. You have a lot of people that know you that are calling you to say like, hey, can you come over and do this, or, you know, whatever. And then you have this thing that you know you need to devote a certain amount of time to the job. So it's, you know, it's hard trying to figure out that balance.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so glad that I did it, though, because I wake up every day and I know that I'm doing something that I care about. And, you know, working with people to help them with the marketing of their business, and
Slava's,
especially getting
Slava's
them started.
Zombie Psycho Circus?
Yeah.
It's pretty rad.
SlavaZombieCircus.com. It's like a... It's like a haunted house, but you shoot back zombies with
paint guns. Yeah. Paintball guns. It sounds awesome.
Sweet.
You get to shoot zombies. Probably not in the head, though. It's probably discouraged.
Yeah. I mean, these are people that are just starting out a business, and it means a lot what I'm doing for them. So I feel good about that. I can go to sleep feeling good about that.
And put it aside?
Yeah.
Or do you still...
I still think about it a lot.
But it's a creative
but
excitement,
it's okay.
Probably.
Yeah.
No, I worked in retail a little bit. And the closest situation I had to that was, I think for like maybe a month, I worked at a Radio Shack in like the mid-90s.
That was like Radio Shack's heyday.
Yeah, it was.
Yep.
And it was awful. I mean, I felt dirty because they were really pushing you to upsell things to the customers.
Upselling is the worst thing ever devised by mankind.
But they totally justified it. It's like, well, this person came in to buy a CB radio, and you didn't upsell them to a nicer antenna. So they're just going to be in their car saying, well, why can't I get the reception I want? Well, because you didn't sell them the antenna that they should have
bought. What if the antenna they had was fine, though?
Shut up.
Does not compute. Does not compute.
That's the response you get. Shut up and go sell an antenna, you jerk.
I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean.
And yeah, you would. I would come home from that and kind of, I assume like you would, and just like, I need to shower now.
In order to do it right, too, you had to put real emotion behind it, and you had to really convince these people
that's the best thing to do.
But they're not buying the product. That's the thing about sales. You're never buying the product. You're buying the person.
Yeah, if you're doing it right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's why you, if you're not selling something you absolutely love and can make your peace with the process, then it's going to destroy you. I had the experience of selling stuff I liked because I sold for PC Richard for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And they like told me they were going to groom me for a store manager. And I've been running away from that kind of shit for years. But it got to the point where it was like, I'm good at it. And I actually like kind of the shit I'm selling. But the pressure is so competitive in the store, like amongst the sales guys. That was fucking. That was like old school boiler room style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a kid. They called me Jimmy Neutron.
And it was in the city too, right? Yeah.
Just a very different. And I was like, I kind of got to that point very quickly. I'm like, I could keep doing this and have a career and be miserable. Or I could, you know, get a waitering job, actually try to act, and, you know, I made that choice, obviously.
Right.
And I work for corporate America, so figure that one out.
But you're doing something that you love. You ended up finding, you know, you ended up finding something that suited your talents.
Yeah, I like my job, but I don't have any illusions about loving it. I mean,
you know. Okay.
But you know what? I'm not miserable at my job. And if I'm not writing novels for a living or at one point acting for a living, then that's about the best I'm ever going to hope for, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt, PC Richards would have stolen your soul
if you stayed there for long. Yeah, I had no doubt. You were there for 2 months. It was already happening after 2 months, and I was like, oh my God. Like, I remember one sales guy ducked a call from a woman who he sold a stove to because he knew she was going to complain. And I stupidly was like, oh, I'm sure I can help her. Let me just answer, I'll take the call. He was just here. It was weird. And she was bitching about when you have the igniter click?
Mm-hmm.
She was bitching about this. She's like, is there any way you can not do that? And I'm like, but no, because that's necessary. That clicking sound is the igniter igniting the gas. So I don't like it. Can you make it quieter? And I was like, fuck, I know why he ducked this call now. Oh my God, what's happening to me? So yeah, sales is awful. Sales read like true. That's why not many people do it anymore. Like the old school retail sales commission shit is horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, there's really an argument to be made that giving people commission is not really a good incentive because in my experience, most of the people of this generation, they want to make money and everything like that, but they don't make a direct connection with how hard they work on this sale and their paycheck. It's more about, doing a good job. And if you're a boss that really is positive with people and rewards, you know, that's the way to go. So you could almost take the commission out of the factor.
And most people have.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people.
I think they've done like psychological studies, which show it's not that as much of a motivation for a lot of people as previously thought.
It speaks to a very specific type of person.
It does, yes.
And they come off like a fucking bull in the china shop most of the time.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that's most people.
No, it's not most people. And most people don't want that experience. How many people are terrified of going to the car dealership because they don't want to get the schmoozy car guy to talk to them? Mm-hmm. People hate that.
Right.
And that's one of the last vestiges of that style of sale that you see, you know?
Yeah, there's a car dealership in my area that gives commission, and they advertise this. They give their commission to sales reps based on their customer score.
Score, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Based
that's
on
a big
their
push.
Satisfaction score.
Yeah, I think one of the, I don't want to give any free advertising, but I think the place where my wife bought her car is like that also.
There are a number of car dealerships locally in the Rochester area that, I don't know if they do that, but they do the we don't negotiate thing.
Yeah, I like that
we
too.
Are giving you a good deal, Kelly Blue Book it, whatever. This, you know, we're not actually going to negotiate. We are pretty comfortable with it. And then you get to concentrate on that, the customer experience.
Mm-hmm.
That is it. I don't mind that. I had to deal a lot with NPS, the Net Promoter Score. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being, you know, not at all, 10 being extremely likely, how likely is it that you would recommend our company to your friends or colleagues? That's the question. And that you see that in so many companies do that now. And it's a lot of ways, like your former telecom employer, that you can game that to fuck and please, all hell.
Just for anyone listening, if you do get a survey like that, give the person a 10, unless they did a bad job.
No, give them
a
9. Give them a 9.
9 or 10, doesn't matter. But give them a good score. Don't give them an 8, because an 8 is
7 and 8 is the worst thing you can possibly do. Oh, my God.
If you get an 8, you will be anally raped by a grizzly bear, is basically how it works.
Well, here's how it breaks down. So 0 through 6 are negative, right? And then 7 and 8 don't count. They're called passives. So 7 and 8 doesn't swing the score at all. It is the worst thing.
But it does. But the thing is, it brings down your score still.
Okay, but from a management standpoint, they hate 7 and 8s because there's no, like, coaching that is really hard. And then a 9 and 10 is positive, so it's be like, oh, good job, you got a 9 or 10. A 9 and 10 are identical. 0 through 6 are technically identical. But the 7 and 8 does influence your score, but it's very difficult to do anything about. So, if you really hate someone, maybe give them a 7.
If you really hate someone, try to get them a job in this industry. Don't blame the customer. This is, you know, the person filling out the survey doesn't know any of this. It's a system that was designed to put pressure on people.
No, I think if we get the knowledge of how the system works into the hand of the consumer on a greater extent, then they can actually use it the way it's supposed to be.
Well, it's a stupid system, and really companies should stop using it, because
I feel like it's getting outdated now.
The thing is that when you give an 8, to me, a lot of people will give an 8 because they've had some experience 20 years ago that was beyond anything ever before, and they're comparing every interaction to that. And so they give you 8, and you talk to them on the phone and say, what could we do better? And they're like, no, you couldn't have done anything better. Yeah. It was great. I just don't give 10s or 9s. It's
you hear
just
that.
8.
You definitely hear that.
So, but that is really terrible for your score. And it basically is like, if you have an 80... And you have, this is how bad it can swing it. So if you have like an 80% NPS for...
100 is the highest, negative 100 is the lowest.
Yeah, like say your company rates your NPS in your unit, division, department, whatever it is. And you have an 80% NPS with 40 surveys.
Which is insanely high.
It's just, it's unbelievable.
No one has that.
And you get one bad survey. It can
bad
go from,
or passive?
I'm going to say detractor. So 0 through 6. Mm. It can go from 80 with that one survey all the way down to 35. I'm not even exaggerating with
math.
Because
it's not an average. It's not.
Because it's not. The way that it's designed is so stupid. Now, originally, and this is why it was scored like that, is that originally it was made so that if you have a positive NPS, then you're doing a great job.
Right.
If you have a negative NPS, then you have work to do. But all of these companies that have adopted NPS, they want to look at their highest performers and to say, you know, this company has 50%. Apple, for example, has like a 50% NPS.
Apple, Harley Davidson, and Southwest Airlines are three of the highest. Mm-hmm. And they all do very specifically unique things that Harley Davidson is employee run, like employee owned, employee run. So everyone gives a shit about who works there. Southwest reinvented the way you get your seating, and they go above and beyond with customer service in a way that no other airline ever has. And then Apple,
we all know it.
We know about the sleek, you know, chic, sexy thing that they do with technology. I think people just, they're kind of wary of Apple, so they like them out of respect of like, if I act like I don't get Apple, then
Steve Jobs is going to haunt me.
He is, and the fucking sweater, he's going to wear the sweater.
I'm banking on the fact that there's one person listening to this podcast who has to deal with NPS, and they're like, holy fucking Luya.
We used to have to make NPS calls. That's part of my job.
Yeah, me too.
Like that is like the late list. I hated calling the late list at the video store. Explain this.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Having to tell someone that their
Ben
and I worked in a video store together. Having to tell someone when you're like a squeaky boy 16-year-old, like, your video's late, I'm gonna have to charge you a dollar. And then like having like fighting with someone because that dollar is a problem for them. Like that's an awkward situation. But the NPS thing is like, I'm going to interrupt your workday. And you clearly don't want to answer this because you haven't done the online version of it. But for the company bonus, I need to get a hold of you.
Yeah.
So you're just asking for a bad score because you are stalking this one
person.
Oh,
you would call them and get a score from them?
Oh, yeah.
We didn't do that. We would call after anybody that gives us a 0 through 8 to ask them why we did so terrible.
Telecom is traditionally negative 45. At least that was when I read the question book that started the whole thing.
So what do you guys think of, I guess, the more recent trend of things like Yelp or like Google ratings for
love it
for businesses.
Yes, it puts great. It puts it in the hands of the people, and trolls can't seem to destroy it, which I like.
And that uses a straightforward math that is an average of the score. And you can understand that. It is what it's meant to do. So if you have an average rating of 4.5 stars on something.
Out of 5.
You know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
That's big. So I love that.
That's a big part of my Amazon shopping experience.
I will sooner trust a stranger.
Yeah.
That seems knowledgeable online than I would somebody who says, hey, I like those towels, you know. I read a thing online.
Oh, you asked me about our towels, and you don't believe what
and
I
then
said.
I wasn't listening.
But
to your
Amazon responses, you trust. He's like, so, I like your towels.
So Amazon had a big deal, though. They had to like redo, and they're probably still working on it. A lot of their scoring.
Oh, was it
because it was getting gamed by the.
Well, that is the
manufacturers, right. The retailers.
If they spam it with, yeah.
That makes sense.
But I will never go just by the stars. I never go just by the review. I will read a handful of reviews for any product that I'm looking
at. I like that Amazon does the most helpful bad review and the most helpful good review.
Because people will be like, this is not a real review.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people will flag that as such. Or you get the Mad Max, did you see this? The Wilton Silver Cake Spray?
I don't think so.
We showed them Mad Max a couple days ago.
Yeah.
And it's just all reviews about going to Valhalla. And my war boys and I meeting up again, and the pearly gates just goes on and on about it.
Mad Max has a couple parts in the movie where someone goes crazy after they spray this silver paint, and it looks like paint, into their mouth. So there's a cake paint that everyone left a review that has to do with Mad Max.
And some people complain, like, you could tell some people were genuinely trying to figure out if it was good paint for cakes. And they were like, all this entire review thread is just... Mad Max references, this is not a good product, don't buy it. I felt so bad for that person. It was like, aw, they were... So yeah, the gaming thing, yes, that is legitimate. But if you're just going by the stars, you're going to get taken in by that. If you're reading the reviews, anyone with half a brain usually can tell when there's a bot or, you know, like a whatever you want to call it. There's a term for that. When a corporation hires someone to write reviews for them.
I think it's just spamming, maybe.
I've heard something else. There was a specific term for it, but I forgot what it is.
I don't know.
Well, they're gaming the system anyway.
They're gaming the system. But that's the thing, is companies are always trying to game the system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I will also get annoyed
when... It's capitalism, baby.
It is. Free market economy. Yep. But I do get annoyed when I buy something for a small company and then they email me 15 times to review them. You ever have that experience? That makes me not want to review them.
Well, Amazon does that whenever you buy anything, really.
But no, the smaller companies, you get individual emails from, and I'll get like, this is our third attempt, please review our product, we're a small company.
Yeah, that's no good.
That's like, you're pandering. I don't like that, so I'm not going to review your product. I might like the product at that point, but like, nope, you have now annoyed me.
You know what I like is TripAdvisor. You ever use that if you travel?
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I mean,
you use that for the Bahama food tours.
I use that all the time. Every time, almost every time we travel and we're just looking for something fun to do. And that's one of those things that rates the experience and everything like that. But you always go and you have a good time and everything. But the ones that do the best are always the people that at the end of it, they say, I, if you enjoyed your experience, go to tripadvisor.com and give us a good ranking. So
I got to wonder about some of these places that like, are towards the bottom of these lists on the like Yelp or TripAdvisor.
If you didn't like us, go on TripAdvisor.
No, I mean, what do you? Assuming you're not a complete idiot, how do you not just go, oh well, we really have to fix this?
I think you're giving. You have to understand that there are a lot of people who run restaurants who don't care because it's just there's a certain amount of money they're making and they're fine with it, or that they don't know. Like, there are still restaurants without websites. That still exists.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are people who generally do not understand the power of the social media, like, the power that it has on their business. There are some who just generally don't care, too. Like, if you get a C rating from your health score, like, there are things you are doing so wrong at that point. Because getting a B at least isn't that hard.
Talk about something that'll keep me from... going into a restaurant.
Yeah, but people will despise it because they have to. But I mean, it's that kind of thing. It's like some people just don't give a shit. Or they don't think they have to play by the rules of every other restaurant or that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But whenever I go out, even like around here, if it's not a place that's getting like at least 3 something
out of 5,
I'm not going to.
Do you automatically look when I see a low review? I automatically look at the number of reviews. Do you
right,
do that?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
One or two, it's like, nah, okay, yeah, that doesn't really mean anything. That. Yeah.
Yep.
That could be an ex-girlfriend.
But yes. If you look at something and it's got very good reviews and there's 4,000 people that have rated it, winning, it's probably great. Yeah.
Charlie Sheening all over that.
Yes.
Charlie Sheening.
Did you guys hear about the end of 2.5 Men?
Yes, I did. Which I saw it actually. I didn't watch
you
it live,
watched it?
But I watched the clip. I went on YouTube and watched it.
I heard they said, oh, his character's dead or something.
They dropped a piano and.
It was the weirdest.
It becomes super meta.
It was just kind of like a fuck you to Charlie Sheen, almost the weirdest thing in television history.
Yeah, that's what some people
are
saying.
The fact that there's this massively popular show and their lead. I mean, the way they end a show is amazingly important. It's the thing that people remember. And yeah. They chose to take this weird dig at Charlie Sheen. And it's really bizarre to watch if you have some time.
I read the blow by blow. But, yeah. But it's also like everything about it, the vanity card, like Chuck Lorre's in it.
Yeah, so here's what happens.
If you don't listen, you probably stop listening at this point.
It's not a spoiler or anything like that. Like
we always give people a heads up
because it's almost completely separate from the narrative. But basically,
there's really a narrative in 2.5.
Well, yeah, they had to survive two of their actors going crazy and leaving, right? The kid too, right?
I guess.
Yeah, the kid went crazy religious. I don't know if you. I think he just got fed up with the show. Yeah.
But he's fundamentalist from what
he
I
is?
Yeah. I think he is. I don't know if it's directly because of that, but I think, yeah.
But
he's
no, he is,
because
he said,
religious.
I would never condone the things I've said as my character. It's evil and that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, you can look it up.
Okay.
That kid has less credibility in my mind.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't give that kid any credibility.
Okay. I see him being a little bit more on it than...
Well, okay, compared to Charlie
Sheen?
What's
his name Sheen? From... No, from the... Oh my God! What was that 80s show?
Oh, Kirk Cameron.
Kirk Cameron, yeah.
Yeah, he Kirk Cameron'd a bit.
Yeah, not
hitting
quite
Kirk Cameron
Kirk
all over the place.
All level of religious.
Kirk Cameron's like David Koresh
insanity.
Level.
I'll say
yeah,
it. Yeah,
like he's
kind
of.
He's like privately religious, which is fine. I think Kirk Cameron is more the. You know, try to prove things based on.
It's like evangelical, and I'm going to try to do it in Hollywood, which doesn't.
Because having moral objections to things that happen on 2.5 Men is one thing.
That's fine.
Having moral objections to things that happen on Growing Pains. Come on.
Come on, Kirk Cameron.
He has a moral objection to evolution.
Yeah, he's got a moral objection to a lot of stuff. He did the Left Behind movies, Mike. Come on. Not Leftovers. Easy mistake to make.
So 2.5 Men at the end, there's these two people, John Cryer and this fat lady, I don't know who that is, sitting out back behind their house, and they're looking up at the sky, at the stars, and it seems like this is where the show is going to end. And then one of them is like, I don't remember exactly, so forgive me if this is completely wrong, but they look up and they're like, what is that in the sky? I think it's a piano. And then it cuts to the front door where this guy that looks like Charlie Sheen from the back is hitting the doorbell.
No, he's out to kill them. There's a whole plot where he's been alive all this time, kept in a well. Like,
see, I don't actually watch 2.5.
No, I read it, well, because apparently reading the article is a lot better than watching the episode when it's you. There's a whole plot where they killed Charlie Sheen off when he left the show and couldn't do it anymore.
Okay.
And then they revealed in this episode that he had been kept at the bottom of a well in a woman's basement, Silence of the Lambs style.
By his ex-girlfriend
yeah, who was like sleeping and fucking him and feeding him, and that was basically it. And he escapes. And the whole thing is he's coming to kill Ashton Kutcher and John Cryer at the end.
Because...
And Arnold, you're leaving out all the Arnold Schwarzenegger shit.
I didn't know about that.
What? Did you watch? You
okay,
only
well,
watched
let me
the
just,
very end.
Let me
then.
Just finish what happens at the very end. So the very end...
I think you're doing a very good job.
I know. So Charlie Sheen hits the doorbell. A piano falls on him. That happens.
Crushes him.
And then the camera pans back, and there's Chuck Lorre, the creator of the
show.
You
see it's a set.
You see
it's
that
acknowledging
it's
that the doorway was a set.
Chuck Lorre is sitting on a director's chair. It says Chuck Lorre on the back of his chair. And he turns around and he goes, winning.
And then a piano comes and falls on him.
And that's the end of the show. Isn't that the most
It gets weirder,
thing
though. So that's it's
that,
meta.
That moment of silence was me just staring blankly at Ben after that explanation.
But there's more craziness because throughout the episode, they go to the police because Charles Sheen's trying to kill them. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is the detective that they're trying to work with. And what he does is he dissects the plot of the show, the entire run of the show, and points out all the plot holes and how nothing ever makes sense on the show. And it's like this, and I think he apparently looks at the camera a few times. Like, there is a massive meta thing that happened in the final episode, and people just didn't know, like, what? And then the vanity card, so Chuck Lorre is famous for his vanity cards, right? At the end of every episode of every show, he does Big Bang Theory, does it too. It cuts to a white card, and then it's a lot of text. You have to pause it to read it. And he does a little message, like, oh, the real, you know, the idea behind this episode was this. And he goes, here's the ending that we originally wanted to do. So according to the vanity card, and it might be true, they wanted to go to Charlie Sheen and say, hey, we would really like to end this with you having, you know, cutting to you, you be on the show, and we will kill you on the show. But then at the end, you get a little moment to say about how, like, drugs and alcohol abuse are really bad for you, but not to you, because you are a tiger god, and you can, you know, drugs don't affect you at all. Like, they're basically playing to his insanity and his hubris. And then apparently he said, no, what I want you to do is I want you to end it without killing me, have a very heartwarming scene where we all reconcile, and then we do a spinoff show called The Harpers or something. And I don't know how true that is. But then, like, Chuck Lorre at the bottom of the vanity card is, we also thought that was very funny and didn't do it. So then you got the ending that you got. I don't know. I know that Chuck Lorre was beyond angry at Charlie Sheen. Like, that was all in the news. Like, so, but it's weird to see revenge of this caliber in this meta narrative for a show that I don't think ever displayed that kind of meta sensibility.
Yeah, for a show to just have a run as long as that had with as many fans, and then in the last episode they completely changed the formula and have this weird episode where they just go off the rails. It's a pretty weird thing in television.
I never really watched it. I mean, I watched like a little bit, and I was like, yeah, okay, this isn't
funny.
That funny. Mm-hmm. My parents love it.
Yeah, mine too.
It speaks to a certain type of viewer that happens to be a very large segment of population based on Chuck Lorre's success.
Which I found kind of weird, because my parents are kind of a little on the conservative side.
Yeah, but we've talked about humor before. When you can make the viewer feel a little smart because you broadcast the punchline a little before it happens. Like, I'm pretty sure this is what Chuck Lorre does so much, because Big Bang Theory was like this too. Like, when you broadcast subtly... I know. And Big Bang Theory is, like, seductive enough because they use the geek culture and nerd culture correctly a lot of the time. But then you realize this is still just a standard setup, punch-deliver, you know, sitcom. So if I was like, I can't deal with the show anymore.
You're talking about Two Broke Girls right now.
Sure.
I hate that about that show. Sure. I hate that show.
I believe it.
Yeah. What?
It's such a show where...
Two Broke Girls.
Is this a real show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's been on for a couple years now.
It's really bad.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, two waitresses.
The whole thing that I don't like about that show, though, is that every moment is leading up to a punchline.
And you can see it coming.
Always feel it. And it's like, these characters would not be doing this thing if there's not a punchline coming.
And then a punchline happens.
That's just bad writing. But it's one of the best shows in the country in terms of ratings.
But Big Bang Theory does... all of Chuck Lorre's stuff follows this formula. And it's why your parents watch it. It's why your parents watch it. There is a comfort to feeling a little smart. And being able to see where... I believe this. And I think this is why improv is... I think there's a certain aspect of improv to this. When you can play the audience a little bit and make them feel smart, they fucking love it, right? That is a formula for comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You could totally, surprise. We talked about that, how my definition of comedy that I got from Erica was like, it's interruption. And you laugh at that. Or it could be exactly what you were expecting in just the right way, so that you're like, huh, I saw that coming, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I get you, right? Chuck Lorre, you're hilarious. But then to do that at the end of that kind of show, that's just bizarre.
Totally weird.
It's so weird.
Mm-hmm. In a different context, it's funny. I mean, it's funny to talk about it and everything.
Describing
like
it to someone who doesn't know, like this mic, is like... Right. And when I was reading the article, I'm like, what the fuck?
I think that they actually had an animated scene of Charlie fucking a goat at one point.
They did. They did do an animated... I don't know what happened in it, but they had to do an animated scene because they couldn't show him. Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It was a massive revenge against Charlie Sheen by Chuck Lorre. And the network was like, yeah, I guess go for it.
And it's weird. This is all kind of context. If you'd said... If there was that scene in, like, South Park, you'd be like, oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So.
It is.
But in two and a half men, it just seemed like...
Situational comedy?
Yeah.
But there's your dichotomy. South Park is the comedy of interruption. Two and a Half Men is the comedy of, okay, underhand deliver cut my balls with the punchline.
So that's interesting theory. You think that if the average television viewer can feel like they know the joke that's coming
on some level,
then they actually like when their intelligence is rewarded. And yes. Actual intelligent people
who see it coming a mile away and it feels like it's pandering and 2x4 method dislike it.
Yeah, because comedy to me is unexpected. It's interruption happening
when you can't see that joke coming. But look at what's the most popular type of television shows: procedurals and sitcoms, and yeah. They all follow a formula.
The plot is about the unexpected happening in those shows, like the procedural shows.
But they're trying to figure out.
Well, if you're watching it on a different level of saying, like, what would be the most unlikely thing to happen,
yeah,
then you're probably going to, 9 times out of 10, you're going to know what's going to happen.
Why did so many old people like JAG?
Oh, I don't even know.
But that's my point. It had a formula. And when you watch 2 episodes in, you get the formula. And then you start to feel smart. Yeah, I absolutely believe that.
I was gonna say something about, like, Law & Order, which is a show I watched all the time.
Mm-hmm, me too.
But and sometimes it was predictable. But I think they kind of got meta with it for some of the episodes. Because it used to be like every episode you could say, oh, I know who that actor is. He's going to be the bad guy.
Right, because he's not going to be on this
any again. Guest actor who it has a recognizable name or face is going to be the rapist.
Not a good formula.
Yeah, but they start. I think they played around with that in a few of the episodes. Him. Ha-ha.
I love that what might have happened is that they had some named actors that they were trying to get, and that in the negotiations they couldn't get him until they were like, well, you're going to be the rapist.
And then they were like, okay. Bad guy. Yeah.
Sweet.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was like, okay, you got it. All right, let's do it.
You went with Philip Seymour Hoffman, I went to Haley Joel Osment.
Oh, man.
Because I feel like Haley Joel Osment has reinvented himself as this weird, like, kind of douchey character actor. You yeah. notice that? He's kind of funny.
I don't know. I haven't seen him in anything.
Okay, go ahead.
But he did that mock miniseries that Will Ferrell did about the oil family with Tobey Maguire.
I didn't see that.
It's actually kind of enjoyable. What were you going to say?
One funny little trivia thing about the Law & Order universe.
Uh-huh.
Is like it has a couple of like weird overlaps with reality.
Okay.
And one of them is that I keep forgetting actors and actresses' names. Pretty Woman is
Julia
Roberts.
Roberts.
Right. Eric Roberts' sister or something, right? I think. Yeah. Right?
She's never been introduced as that.
No, I know.
Eric Roberts always introduced as Julia Roberts' brother.
Eric Roberts.
We are big sister. Eric Roberts I know who you're fans. Talking about.
Yeah. Eric Roberts' daughter, however, is constantly introduced as Eric Roberts' daughter. She plays a bitch in everything.
But anyway, there's one Law & Order episode where she appears as a guest.
As herself?
Not as herself.
Okay.
But she's obviously, you know, she's playing a person who's in that universe.
Okay.
And there's another episode where somebody makes a reference to Julia Roberts.
Oh.
So in the Law & Order universe... Julie Roberts has a twin.
No. What you're saying is Julie Roberts is Schrodinger's cat. She can both exist and not exist.
There you go.
At the same time within the Law & Order universe. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But she's known for doing that because they did the exact same thing in Ocean's 12.
That's actually true, yeah.
What is it with Julia Roberts and the Schrodinger's cat thing?
I don't know.
Fucking weird.
This rabbit hole goes deep.
Whoa. What the bleep do we know kind of rabbit hole?
The bigger... universe issue is with Saint Elsewhere.
Oh,
talk about end of shows. You guys probably didn't watch Saint Elsewhere.
No, but tell me.
At the end of Saint Elsewhere, the final episode of the final season, there's like things happen, and then at the end they pan back.
Shit gets real,
and it's this autistic kid who is the son one of not a character from St. Elsewhere, but the same actor playing
the
kids from like the 80s.
You guys ruined St. Elsewhere for me. Oh, I'll never listen to your podcast. Worst podcast ever. NPS score of -10.
Okay, so it's an actor who's playing one of the doctors, and then at the end of it, he's this kid's father, but not a doctor. And the kid is looking at a snow globe that has St. Legius or whatever, the hospital, in it.
And he's concocting the whole story.
Everything is in his head. So that means that this whole thing is in his head.
Okay.
But the show actually had tie-ins during its run to like three or four other shows.
Like when they did they were going to do the Picket Fences X-Files crossover. And there was a time in the 90s when they were doing lots of crossovers.
They were doing, I forget to which shows they did, but when you get into it, it makes all of these other shows just figments of this one kid's imagination.
Well, it could be that kid likes those shows, and then and they get involved with
shoehorn them into the...
Yeah, he's doing fan fiction.
I have your comics, by the way, remind me. I read them. Sorry, that just reminded me.
All right.
Speaking of that.
Do we want to talk about that?
No, we're well over, and Ben hasn't read Unwritten.
So. Okay.
We can talk about it next
time. Do you like it?
Yeah.
You like the end?
Yeah.
All right.
I don't need super happy ending. I need legit ending.
All right.
Comic series.
Was it an autistic kid looking at a snow globe?
Not quite, but kind of.
I will say that we showed them Stardust for the first. Speaking of,
did you like Stardust?
Yes,
I love that.
Yeah, speaking really of, good. And I've never heard of it before.
It's such a charming film.
Yeah,
it is the modern Princess Bride. I think it's the best way to describe it. It has that same vibe. But my thought was, Unwritten is a Vertigo comic. Neil Gaiman wrote Sandman, which is a Vertigo comic. Neil Gaiman wrote Stardust. So we showed them Stardust. That was how I got there.
Yeah, it definitely has that vibe, that Princess Bride vibe.
The snarky, sarcastic...
And it's the same director who did Kingsman, The Secret Service.
Kingsman, yeah. And, and
which I hardly recommend.
You hardly... Something you said.
Heartily.
You threw your hands up like, I hardly recommend this.
Heartily recommend it. This is a better...
Yeah, that's... gesture. Going for the buttocks is way better.
He's
really working great for visual here.
But this is why we always have to describe everything they're doing. So Smike basically looks like he's grabbing two giant butt cheeks with gusto and saying, heartily recommend the Kingsman. You are grabbing the ass of Kingsman and you are just fucking digging those claws in.
I am.
But Stardust is a very charming movie.
Yes. De Niro, I would also... recommend Stardust. I would grab the ass of Stardust heartily.
There was something weird about De Niro's performance at first, and I was like, it almost seems like, is he phoning it in on this movie?
But then you
find out that it's not what it appears to be.
It's intentional.
It's not De Niro's best work,
But the thing with the character, the twist of the character...
He's a very enjoyable character.
It's enjoyable, but no. But what Ben's getting at is that the twist with his character explains at least the...
It does.
Seemingly lack of acting kind of thing earlier, but... No, but it's funny that Charlie Cox is now Daredevil, because he's such a ingenue character in that, and then he's like badass blind lawyer by day, badass superhero by night now. I never found Claire Danes attractive, so that just like the
weakest. Really, I actually have a thing for Claire Danes.
I can't get it. Her face does not do it for me. She has no forehead. It's fucking weird. Zero forehead. I'm like, the whole time last night, as I wasn't falling asleep because I was kind of tired, I was like, where is your forehead, Claire Danes? Where?
Aw.
I don't know if I ever noticed that before.
I've ruined Claire Danes for you now. Just stare at her forehead. Just the next time you see a movie, be like, it's not there.
Sometimes you can't describe why you have it for this actress or that actress.
Yeah, it's a combination of the character, her actress type.
Yeah, she does it for me. Always has.
How about you? Are you a Claire Danes fan?
Oh, no.
I don't know now.
I need to take another look at the forehead. Sometimes, though, I've heard when you stare at Claire Danes' forehead, the forehead stares back at you.
Yeah, because her eyes are right there. Because there's no forehead. Oh, yeah, that's the problem.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Abyss illusions you're making are legit. Buddies in Space is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. Visit StolenDress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books. I believe that the Million McFly March, raising money for Parkinson's research, has happened, and I do hope it was a smashing success. Well done to Jason Clam for organizing that. I did next to nothing to help, so I suck.
Thanks, Wink.
We could just record that once and then keep reusing it.
No! Because we get to make guests do it, so now Ben needs to do it.
Wait, what do I need to do? Do I have to do it?
Read the skip the alternatively. So do one of these two. Your podcast name is Buddies in Space, and then read the second part.
Buddies in Space is a member of the Stolen Dress Entertainment Podcast Network. Visit StolenDress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books.
Yeah, that was good.
Nice, clean.
Think I have a voiceover career?
No.
Maybe.
I'll call it Mumbly Production.
You went to me for the phone stuff.
True.
I I got an email from
he's
Ben.
The voice of my of web my, design. Yeah, web design company. if you call my number.
I used all this equipment to record it.
Yeah, and it's good. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
I've recorded a couple of auto attendants in my day. I know my way around an auto attendant message. Time of days, nighttime mode, I got that shit down cold.
Is that Hall & Oates one still going?
Yes. That's awesome. You want to hear it? Let's see if I can capture it. So as a birthday present to Smike one year, I used my nefarious connections, and Erica had found this thing. So Smike loves Hall & Oates. And Erica had found
this. I don't love Hall & Oates.
You fucking love Hall & Oates.
They were a part of my childhood.
You fucking want to grab their asses. So Erica found this thing that it used to exist called the Call & Oates line.
Okay.
And we checked it and it had been disconnected. So I'm like, well, I need to spend 2 days recreating this. So it's like legit, dude. It's all there.
Thank you for calling the Call & Oates line. Your number one source for low quality phone based versions of your favorite Call & Oates hits. To listen to Time of Five, press 1 now. To listen to Man Eater, press 2.
Yeah.
Now. So this is what happens if you hit the wrong number. So if you actually choose one of the numbers. It's like super bad quality.
It actually sounds like hold music.
Yeah.
I was hoping you were going to go for Man Eater.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'd have to dial back in. Anyway, I don't want to give the number out because I don't want my company to be like, why is this number that we're not making any money on getting all these fucking calls? Because then they're definitely going to kill it. But that's the Call & Oates line. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We got some great, an amazing political research breakthrough from you.
The Trump.
2 a.m. The Trump theory. Well, the 2 a.m. CNN
thing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Trump theory, too. So
I got a lot of theories, people.
Tons of them.
You guys just leave and I'll keep talking into the mic.
I'm going to go read The Atlantic.
Ben spoke for 8 hours after we stopped recording. This was recorded at a later time. He won't let us leave. He found my knife collection. It's bad. Smike may not make it out. Ben, thank you for joining us. It's been awesome. You are?
As Michael Smith, and you
are M. Michael Crossy, and you are?
Benjamin Corey Benjamin.
Benjamin?
Corey Benjamin.
You're Benjamin? Mm-hmm. Benjamin Curry.
Benjamin. That's number 8.
Simon went on a pony ride today.
Oh, did he? Was he terrified? Adorable.
He was so cool. He acted like he didn't care that he was on a pony for the first time. He was just like, whatever.
He might as well have been sitting on a, a high chair.
Yeah, it was.